Hi, and welcome to the 12:30 panel. First of all, thank you all for coming, and I guess we'll start. So, right here, this was my very first rudimentary crowdsourced map, but was also, not only that, but it was also my first South by Southwest experience a few years ago, and as you can see, it is very accurate. Now, thanks to Public Laboratory for Open Technology and Science and its growing community, not only do I have the tools to create high-resolution aerial maps with balloons, but so do over 500 people globally. In the past year, I've seen very diverse projects emerge from the Public Laboratory community, diverse in both scope and location. Projects like monitoring Superfund sites in Gowanus Canal, Brooklyn, with infrared cameras, balloon mapping Occupy UC Davis, and mapping oil spill affected sites in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida. And that's why I put this panel together, to share Public Lab's work with the South by Southwest community. Each panelist will give a brief introduction of themselves, talk about their involvement with the Public Lab community, and then we'll dive into a few prepared questions before we leave time at the end for audience Q&A. So Shannon, would you like to start?
So like Jen was saying, we are an organization that has developed in a couple of different ways. We have a nonprofit core that includes about 8 different staff members, but we have approximately 500 people from across the globe that contributes both online and offline in their local communities to the work that we're doing. So the basic premise of Public Laboratory is to develop and design low-cost, DIY, open-source, open-hardware tools to do environmental monitoring with. We're also unique in that we don't just have technologists on staff or cartographers. We also have people that are from the social sciences that have history working in activism and community organizing and wetlands remediation. So we combine a lot of different. So we came together because we saw a couple different primary issues with how environmental science and health research was being done, as well as how people were approaching what's traditionally called citizen science, whereas Public Lab takes a civic science approach. Basically, there was a lack of access that we were seeing for people who were trying to collect data on their own, as opposed to having to rely on data that was being generated by government agencies or other institutions. So first being, a lot of times, access to monitoring tools and to the data can be really expensive. It's also many times limited to the hands of what we traditionally consider experts or academics. There's also a lot of times a lag in knowledge between experts and the people that are doing data collection for them, which is the traditional citizen science model. People on the ground typically, in communities, don't end up owning the data. It typically goes back to academics or researchers. They also don't always understand how it's made. I'm from Louisiana, where this is a huge issue. Industry has a far greater capacity to actually generate data than people that are being affected by industry. So with a civic science approach to environmental monitoring, what we're trying to do is take this back and make the entire process of development around tools, design around tools, community-oriented and developed. We also want it to be community-owned from the beginning of the process all the way to the advocacy that ends up happening. One of the ways that we do this is by using open-source, open-hardware licenses because this allows for tools to be adapted and spread in really unanticipated directions. And we also hope that it will support public exploration and investigation of environments and transform what we typically consider experts and include locals into that category as well because they are the experts of their own areas. So just a bit of background on myself. I am, like I said, from Louisiana, and I was working with an organization, a watchdog NGO around the oil refineries in Louisiana called the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. I was working specifically with what we consider fence line communities or communities that directly sit next to these industrial facilities. And this was my first exposure to using low-cost DIY type technology to do monitoring. This was a tool that was developed by a group called Global Community Monitor. It's based on the EPA's SUMA canister, and this is a way for people to collect grab samples. Communities that are around industrial facilities were getting really tired of not having a way to do their own air sampling. Flare would be released, which is basically a big blast of emissions, and they would call the EPA or the local DEQ, and they would be told, sure, we'll be out in 3 or 4 hours. After that 3 or 4 hours, the flare had typically gone away, and they were left with no ability to take an accurate air sample. So this ended up providing people with a way to do an immediate sample, to send it into a lab to get their own air tested. So then, in 2010, the BP oil spill happened in the Gulf of Mexico, and I switched focuses to start working on that. At the time, Jeff Warren, who was a graduate student at MIT, came down to the Gulf, and we started using what became Public Lab's first tool, aerial mapping, with a kite or a balloon, around monitoring the oil spill as it progressed into the wetlands around Louisiana, the beaches of Mississippi, Alabama, Florida. And so basically, this tool incorporated into community projects with about 200 different volunteers and residents of the Gulf Coast. And we would go out and systematically pick, you know, 10, 15 different areas that we would map to watch and monitor what was happening in the wetlands. And so this has been the model that we've used going forward with all of our projects. Since the initial use in the Gulf Coast, we've seen it spread to sites such as the Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn, New York, to mountaintop removal sites around Butte, Montana. And so everything is community generated. The mapping of the BP oil spill was because there was a media blackout. We didn't have information coming in, and we didn't have a way to get involved with what was happening in our own waters. And so by giving people tools to go out and do their own sampling and monitoring, we were able to get people involved in what was happening. And from the mapping, we were able to collect images such as this in Barataria Bay. And this is an area that there's also oyster reefs in, which is really important to Louisiana's economic sectors. So in these images, you can see oiled shoreline, discarded boom, and we've mapped this site probably about 5 times since then. And these images end up being about 2 to 8 centimeter pixel resolution, which is really great. So one of the reasons that we've been able to spread the way that we have and kind of transform the way that information is generated is that we use these couple of licenses. So right now we're using an open source share alike license, but we're in the process of getting general consensus from our entire community and moving to a CERN OHL license. And these licenses are really powerful, we're finding, because it allows us to take projects in a number of different directions. It creates discussions and discourses that are unanticipated, but move tools in ways that we would never have thought. Just as an example, the second image in on the left-hand side is the initial aerial mapping rig. It was based on a 2-liter soda bottle with cardboard wings. And in the Gulf Coast, we have a lot of humidity, and so it didn't work so well. Since then, it's grown to a number of different iterations that have been used based on local supplies, based on the temperature conditions at different sites.
This is where we are now.
And then we also, along with this, we create online products. So we have what's called the Public Lab Archive. And this is a way for us to take the data that's being generated by communities and translate it back into industry standards. So on this site, which was modeled after data.gov, we're able to have people write field notes, to leave comments. And then we also have these maps accessible in formats such as GeoTIFF, TMS, open layers that can be easily downloaded because they're all held in the public domain. Beyond some of our online tools, we're also going back to traditional, very non-technological formats such as what we're calling the Grassroots Mapping Forum, which are large newspaper prints. In Louisiana, we don't always have the greatest access, especially once you get outside our major cities, to internet. And so we've printed out maps and started distributing them, you know, at marinas, different grocery stores, seafood restaurants, places like that where people will be able to get best access to information.
Great. it was on this Gulf Oil spill that I became involved as a volunteer from a distance, as an online volunteer, and I'm now one of the staff members of the public laboratory. I'm the director of production, which means I handle all of our kit production and print production and retail sales, but I'm also the manager on our balloon mapping tool. And I got into it because balloons are my hobby, and prior to this, I was building balloons. This is a solar hot air balloon. These are my pre-public laboratory balloons. Very large, very fun. I like building kites, too. And it was through this involvement and just advice and you know, shooting messages out on the mailing list and doing work after work on public lab work that I got involved. But my other work, I work part-time, my other work is on toilets and sanitation. So I started this Kloakina project 2 years ago as a design issues in sanitation. Kloakina is the Roman goddess of the sewers. So I work with Recode Oregon and international development agencies, CWAS, and the Sustainable Sanitation and Water Management Toolkit. I do informative graphics, like all the toilets of the world, and work with my grad students to do toilets. This is building out a toilet system that was based on the system used by Soil in Haiti and by the Northwest Permaculture Convergence after the earthquake in Christchurch. And so, design hand sinks and things like this. This is most of my day-to-day work. And you can see it if you're in Atlanta at the Center for the CDC in collaboration with Emory University is having a show coming up here in March. So, for public laboratory, I'm also the maintainer of this balloon tool. And for our website, you know, we went from this mailing list, right? This mailing list that came together very spontaneously around the oil spill. And then we had the question of, okay, where do we go from here? Our tool's going in different directions. Things are getting embedded in our conversations that are very difficult to access because, you know, you have a little tiny note that's at the completely unrelated to the subject line somewhere down the mailing list. And we were thinking, where do we go? Do we go to a forum? Do we go to a wiki? And what we decided to do was go somewhere in between. So we base our system around these notes. You can go to our website and you create a research note. You click, create a title, throw in some research, throw in a couple things, and you end up with something like this. So this is from Jesse Breen. This is her Pika Bay rig, which is a great rig for stabilizing images. That's our single line rig that we're passing around. But this is something really simple. She was able to just throw this together really quickly and throw a research note up. And then what I do is I monitor the mailing list, I monitor all these notes coming in, and try to help keep the wiki updated so our wiki forms a kind of a permanent documentation record. And we think that that's important, you know, in terms of community involvement. It's really important to allow kind of spontaneous, quick bursts of information from volunteers, but also provide really coherent documentation so that people can copy our tools. And yeah, so this is our wiki page with balloon and kite mapping, you know, and it's always being updated with the latest info on how to build out our tools. So, pass it on to Greg Foster, who's one of our volunteers.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out today. My name is Gregory Foster, and I think probably in the context of this panel, it's appropriate for me to say that I'm a public labs groupie. And I think that probably everyone here, after hearing the good work that these folks are up to, you might consider self-identifying in a similar manner. By day, I'm a computer geek for Consumer Reports, but my interest in connecting up with public labs folks goes back longer than that. In 2006, I was working with a small NGO in Thailand, and we actually were tasked with actually generating some maps of the island of Koh Tao. At that time, Google didn't have very high-resolution imagery of the island. And at that time, through the process of doing all of that, walking around with a handheld GPS receiver and such, you know, you started to realize that there's probably better ways to approach this sort of thing, and started thinking about, well, what is the appropriate use for maybe remote control aircraft or things like that, strapping a camera to it and taking some footage. So it was a short time after that I heard about the grassroots mapping work that they were doing through public labs, and was exceptionally excited to see that someone had actually gone out there and was doing this work. I think that was actually as a result of the mapping that was happening as a result of the Deepwater Horizon spill. which also being that I'm based here in Austin and grew up on the Gulf Coast, struck very close to home. So as a result, started following the work that they're doing, signed up for their mailing lists, have been basically a tireless advocate for their work and evangelist for their work because it's good work. And as a result of meeting the members of Public Lab, I find out that they're not only basically each a genius to a T, but also very, very good-hearted folks and doing good work. And so wanted to support their efforts in that regard. And I'm just happy to be here. Can provide some context on some different things. I've done a lot of thinking about kind of the intersection between, or the overlap between the balloon mapping or kite-based approach and the rapidly new world of drone-based journalism and mapping that we're heading towards. So,
excellent. Thank you. Well, first of all, you've all mentioned quite a few different communities and geographic areas that you've worked in, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the tools that different communities are using and some of the limitations and challenges of using civic science as tools for advocacies and how these challenges can be overcome.
So from our initial aerial mapping tool, we've developed out a number of different ones, and we kind of at this point have a couple of different tracks going. Can everybody hear me? All right, good. Which also include environmental health tools. So one of the newest projects that we're working on is developing hydrogen sulfide sensing in gas patch communities. And so we started out by using industrial sensors attached onto a breadboard in Arduino. And we've since started talking to researchers, you know, that are using silver halide photographic paper. And we're talking with communities in Texas that are using copper rods. So that's one instance of an environmental health tool. We're also working on indoor air toxic mappers using a Roomba or a hamster ball with formaldehyde sensors. We have a spectrometer that's based on a VHS cassette case, an $8 webcam, and a broken CD. And so we're trying to make a $30 version of what is traditionally $70,000. You know, our infrared camera that's based on remote sensing research that NASA has done to look at wetland health. So we have a number of different projects that we have up and running. And we have some with us if you want to take a look afterwards. Some of the barriers, I think, as with all models of citizen or civic science, is definitely getting data that is community generated, recognized by the EPA, by your state DEQs, your county or parish governments. That's definitely been an issue. One of the ways that we're hoping to begin the conversation on remedying this is by creating a really diverse community where it's not, you know, only local community members, but also researchers working, you know, with community members, but also through open source and open hardware models where we can begin kind of creating a new rhetoric around how tools are developed.
Yeah, I would say to that, it can be very difficult because some of these outcomes that people want, you know, recognition of their data can be very long term. So, you know, legal work around imagery we've produced in the Gulf is just getting going, and we don't know how long that's going to be, that process. And that's probably the most frustrating aspect of it, is that a lot of these outcomes have to go through legal processes and other things like that in order to get recognition. And it's a lot easier to collect data than to do all the follow-up of legal advocacy and that work. And so that's something that, you know, even now, 2 years after the spill, is still just starting, you know.
Regarding the question of the legitimacy of the data, isn't there something that y'all are working on here now in coordination with Google as far as getting some of the actual imagery generated by community activists on Google Maps?
Yes, Christian's giving me the thumbs up that I can say that. So yeah, we have released all of our public domain maps to Google Earth, and they are in the process of being paired on their system. So that is one tool, yeah.
Yeah, and one thing we look at is trying to automate a lot of the kind of back-end formatting that people have to do on data. And so that's something that we've
we've gotten very far on with the balloon, balloon mapping, balloon kite mapping, and are working on with our other tools. So our MapKnitter tools, which is a software tool for doing map stitching, allows us to handle all of the exporting into GDAL and GeoTIFFs and all of the those formats for individuals. So you just have to build a map, and then you don't have to actually deal with the georeferencing and all of that kind of professional data formatting. And we have a heavy emphasis on, you know, automating that data formatting so that people don't have to deal with it. And we're starting to get into collection methodologies and working on chain of custody issues for data so that when it goes back, we have kind of signed chain of custody for our data to demonstrate who had it and when, which is important for our legal outcomes.
I was wondering if you could provide some more context where, like, the different communities that are using these tools, like where they are geographically and what are they thinking about and what are the policy issues that they're trying to work on by using all of these tools that you've just listed.
Sure. So we have a number of different communities around the globe. And the way that we work, so we have 8 staff members. All of us are in different states. All of us kind of have our pet projects that we work on personally. But people have taken up especially the aerial mapping, because that's our tool that's furthest along. We just finished a Kickstarter where we sent out 300 different balloon mapping kits, so I have a feeling we're going to see another surge soon, but we have people in the Czech Republic that are using aerial mapping to look at what, you know, is potentially illegal logging in one of their national parks. We have people in Rio de Janeiro that are mapping neighborhoods, and Mexico City that are mapping their neighborhoods, in Butte, Montana, that are pairing aerial maps with historical community maps, as well as beginning to look at mountaintop removal sites. Gowanus Canal, which is a Superfund site that's set for mediation in 2013. They're doing monitoring up until that point. Across the Gulf Coast, we're starting to look at wetland sites to see how erosion is happening, not only because of the oil spill, but because of our sensitivity to hurricanes at this point.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's looking for something different. So in the Gowanus Canal, one of the big things they've been looking for are unmapped waterways. And they found 2 or 3 thus far that were just inflows that weren't on any maps, which are fundamental to the cleanup effort. I was just thinking today, actually, there's a workshop running in D.C. Some folks are going to go out and map a park, and the park is fairly small and covered over with, there's several areas of the park that are actually under bridges. And so they've been trying to do these ecological surveys of the park, and but they don't have any using maps, but the maps end at the bridge. So they're actually using the fact that we have low-altitude tools to get pictures underneath that that area. So there's been a lot of uptake, and it's interesting.
And I also wanted to mention, I guess we're a community that started with a premise around environmental justice. That was what we were focusing on with the oil spill. But, you know, as I was saying, unanticipated directions as well. This past August, when the education reforms were happening in Chile, a group, an NGO there, began to do protest mapping where they sent up one of these camera rigs but used the iPhone and live streamed what was happening during the protests. So 10,000 people were watching it as it was happening. And their goal in doing this was to show that there were far more people than what the state perspective was. It's also helped... people have taken it up at Occupy movements that we didn't even know about. We kind of happen across the maps every once in a while. For instance, at Occupy Oakland, they have a really great map that I might be able to pull a picture up of. But it takes what can traditionally be seen as a very static kind of corporate or state-derived perspective where there isn't dynamic living happening, and transforms it into you know, the immediate present when people are able to launch something as such. So, you know, that's a couple other
things. I think most of the folks here probably are familiar with the pepper spray incident that happened at UC Davis. And the day after that, I think it was several or two of the actual public labs members went out to the UC Davis campus and put a balloon up to actually generate some maps of the folks that were in attendance there. And speaking as someone that was certainly basically appalled at that particular incident, it was very, very heartening to see these maps come out, or these imagery showing just the magnitude of the response of the students and of local community members that came out in support that next day to show that basically folks are not going to be putting up with that kind of behavior in the States.
And so what do you guys see in further tool development and some of the next steps that you either personally take an interest in for that particular tool with the issue that's associated with it, or a community that you're working with? You know, Gregory's thought about this quite a bit.
So. Sure. So I actually did participate in the local occupation here in Austin, and during that time period, we were interested in different techniques and technologies that could be developed to help in the process, thinking about things innovatively, which we saw a lot of coming out of the occupations. One of those was directly inspired by the protest mapping that happened in Chile, and so we began thinking more and more about that as far as ways to approach that. And that's where kind of the intersection with the drone-based approach to doing mapping and monitoring of these spaces emerged. And we actually had, by South by Southwest serendipity, ran into Tim Poole, who was at TimCast on Twitter, and it's one of the most prolific live streamers from the occupations. And he and his team, we had a chance to talk with them about the Occucopter that they developed based on a modified Parrot AR drone that is able to generate imagery and actually stream. They've modified it such to actually do live streaming as well. So in that sense, I think it's interesting that we have the emergence of similar, well, we have similar use cases for these technologies, balloon-based mapping, kite-based mapping, and now this drone-based approach as well. And it's interesting looking at differences between these approaches, and I think we can probably go into that a little bit more later on. So, but that's one particular aspect of it all.
Yeah, I was thinking about my experiences in Butte, Montana over the summer, and there's a lot of talk at this conference about big data, but a lot of people need small data, they need lots of little data sets. And in Butte, they're doing an EPA reclamation site, EPA reclamation, but the town doesn't really have the money to re-image the whole town. So if you go to Google Maps, you can still see these mining sites that look like huge piles of dirt, where if you go to the town, a lot of them have actually been rebuilt. They're now parks, and they've been, they're covered in cover crops and everything. And kite and balloon mapping offered an opportunity to actually collect that imagery for the city, because, you know, they can only afford to fly a plane every 5 years, but the balloon and kite mapping can do just one piece at a time. So as it's kind of, we talk a lot about this temporal resolution, the importance of capturing moments as they happen and changes as they happen. And that was a good case study in that.
So I know we've talked a lot about tools, and we've talked a lot about the communities that are using them. I know that Public Lab thinks a lot about the development of the tools, whether it's with the Roombas, the cameras, or the kites, but also the software like MapKnitter. And part of that is thinking about how the tools are perceived and how the tools connect with the wider audience. So I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about that. I know, so Matthew, if you could think about like how tools are perceived in use, and how does the shape of an object and the presentation mode of data affect accessibility to further what you were just talking about.
Well, so it used to be that there were big scientific studies that would kind of be landmark studies that people would cite for 30, 40 years sometimes. We're kind of past that, and everyone wants data all the time. And it's important to think about not just getting one piece of data, but what's our data methodology for collecting data, you know, from here till forever? Because no one's ever going to be happy with one measurement. They're going to want to take it over and over again. And so that gets down to, like, what is it to constantly be collecting data in a community, to constantly be trying to get these pieces of data? And balloons and kites, as our kind of archetypal tool, people have all these positive childhood memories with them. They see you flying a kite or a balloon. They come out, they're like, oh, that's neat. Like, I remember flying kites. Like, what are you doing? If you're out flying a drone, they might wonder whether it's going to, you know, whether it has a gun on it or whether it's armed. And it's very confrontational, and you can be hidden, potentially. No one knows where you are. A kite or a balloon is a giant flag that says, I'm over here taking pictures of you. And, you know, when I've been out flying, I try to talk to the neighbors and everything, but if I don't get a hold of anybody, I'm out there trapped on the ground holding a string. I can't just wind my kite in from 2,000 feet and run away. I have to sit there and answer people's questions about what I'm doing. So there's this kind of inherent accountability to doing something publicly. And so we think about that with our other tools, of how we build that kind of fun experience and non-confrontational design into the tool, so that when people see you using it, you know, they can engage with it, they can understand what you're doing, and then you can show them data that is presented in a way that they can understand. So we have a heavy focus on visual information, not visualized data, but visual information. You know, people can look at a map. Anyone can analyze a picture. People feel comfortable looking at pictures and saying, you know, look, that wetland looks good. Those plants are green. Those ones are brown. Those are alive. Those are dying. You know, you can analyze them without getting into heavy technical terms, without getting into quantification. And so I guess the best example would be our thermal imaging we're developing, or the pollution monitoring, where we run a single sensor around a room and take time-lapse images of it. And so we use a multicolored LED on the tool to visualize that one sensor point, and then through time-lapse photography, spatialize that data so that what you get is an image. And anyone can look at the image and identify hot spots in it. So that's a big focus of ours, is that visual images, interpretable data, and non-confrontational tools.
And I think the emphasis there on the kind of fun aspect of it all, I think, is important. I think it's great that it hasn't been lost in an effort that is generating such quantities of information and data. In terms of engaging a community of folks and of making sure that people understand that these techniques and technologies are accessible, that you can go out and you can get some balloons and take your camera and get a soda bottle, basically, and strap it together and create imagery that's an order of magnitude better than what you're going to get from Google satellite imagery of a particular place that you're interested in getting the data from, that you have a particular use case for. You know, that's pretty compelling, and it's really pretty easy to do. And just to plug the fact that later on today we're actually going to do some mapping over at the LBJ fountain at 2:30 today. So if you want to come out and see how it's done, come on out and join us.
And one of the things I found really interesting in leading some mapping workshops, it's also a really great community development tool. So while I was mapping the Newark riverfront in Newark, New Jersey, it was a great way for different community members to actually explore the terrain that was being developed into a park. And so at a very local level, I feel like it does a lot of good as well. But how do you foresee this scaling and going to work in a more traditional or institutional audience, whether it's the federal government or it's a corporation, or how this can be a player in a larger field?
Well, I guess, I mean, first off, our hope is that this can stay as a grassroots mechanism, rather than, you know, we've had a lot of academics and researchers pick up these tools, and a lot of people, you know, are definitely from an academic background that are contributing research ideas and directions. But I think what, rather than see it go that direction, we'd like to see it go a bit more the opposite direction, and make sure that it's we're still having these localized instances of use. That we want to direct our tool development around environmental problems or issues that people in communities are identifying. The lack of access to tools that they might have, and then pulling from the other side, academics or whoever to help with those problems, rather than the other way around.
So. Absolutely. And so, what are some of the next steps? How can Gregory just mentioned we're doing a balloon mapping later today at 2:30, but how? Like, what are some of the best steps in getting your communities at home involved? And what are the implications for future projects with Public Lab, whether it's directly, so what are some of the future projects? So, and how can audience members get involved?
Yeah, so the best way is we have, like we were saying, about 500 people that are participating online to tool development. But to get involved, it's great to sign up so that you can contribute notes back, especially if you have an interest in one of the tools, or if there's something in your community that you've identified as an issue that you'd like to see tools developed around. We have a really great response where people will send something out to the list and say, I have coal slurry that's coming in. Like, what is something I can do to begin doing monitoring around this? And we have people that will respond and start brainstorming, and it's a slow process, and it's a process that's definitely kind of still modeling itself, but it's really exciting to watch it evolve. And
well, I've been working on getting our balloon kits together for retail sales. They'll be in regular retail sales in about 2 weeks. We did a Kickstarter and sold 300 kits, which was great. And I think that's really interesting, is just making things cheap, because we want to kind of scale laterally as opposed to vertically, because you can build it bigger and get lots of data. You can just build it cheaper and give it to lots of people. And so getting all of our tools down to something that someone can buy for cheap and get it quickly and be able to grab it. Because just like with the Louisiana Bucket Brigade's bucket sample, it's about these moments when you don't know you want to get data. You don't know you need to develop a data collection methodology until you need it in like 3 weeks. So you end up with, in like the case in the Czech Republic, they were looking at logging in the state forests, and the federal government announced they were going to log within 4 weeks of the logging. And so these activists kind of scrambled, contacted us, and we tried to give them as much advice as we could. And luckily, because balloon mapping is very flexible, you don't necessarily need to even buy a balloon. You can use Mylar emergency sleeping bags to fill up with helium. They were able to put together a kit in 2 weeks and go out and take images just as the logging was happening. So I really think our next big step is just making things cheaper, making things more accessible faster.
And I hope that the Public Labs members will continue to, as you travel around conferences and the work that you do, that you'll continue to engage with the local communities that you find yourself in. I was lucky enough to travel down to Houston earlier this week to meet up with Shannon and Matthew, where they were doing a technology transfer presentation at the Houston Hackerspace, the TXRX Labs. And actually, that was video conference through to the Austin Hackerspace also, so they could ambiently listen in. And did a presentation there with that maker do-it-yourself community. It's a very natural allies, I guess you could say, and as well members of several organizations, Air Alliance of Houston and the Galveston Area Baykeepers Group, came and converged in that space for that information sharing. So there's good opportunities like that around, and I hope that you'll continue doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, I guess we do see doing a lot of matchmaking going forward. So if you're like a technical person in a community that needs assistance, or you're in a community that needs assistance looking for technical people, we'd love to try to help put you together.
Yeah. And I know for the month of March, there's a March Mapping Madness as well, where Public Laboratory is trying to go into the different cities where kits were actually sold via the Kickstarter campaign and doing meetups. And so today at 2:30 is the March Mapping Madness for the city of Austin. And from there, I know there's already some planned in Boston, New York, and
Vancouver.
It's globally. So if you go to publiclaboratory.org, you'll have to see them all there, and you can sign up and get involved. And you can open it to questions. If anyone has questions for any of the panelists, would love to hear them, or comments.
Yep. So something like this, like crowdsourcing, I would think social media or social networks would be like something that you guys would talk about. I haven't heard much, and I'm wondering if it's because it's so hyper-regional that you need it or you want it, how you use it.
We actually, our perspective on citizen science is basically that it is crowdsourcing, and that's why we're trying to take more of a civic science approach. So it's like it's questioning the state of things rather than generating, you know, state data or data for researchers. So in citizen science, and I was just at a conference in London talking about this, but you know, traditionally you're taking, you know, a group of people, community members, and you're sending them out to look for specific things and then to source that information back to a central location. And so we're trying to, you know, make sure that that data stays community-owned instead of just kind of goes into this abstract platform that people, you know, never see again, right?
I think that's an important distinction. It's a refinement or really kind of a separation in some ways from the traditional ideas of crowdsourcing, where that's more of a top-down approach in some ways, where it's like, okay, we have this massive problem that we want to recruit a large number of people to help us to solve. And instead, the approach that Public Labs seems to take is to distribute the approach to identifying these problems, to encourage critical thinking and understanding and empowerment to individuals.
I was just, that comment was reminding me of some of the work I was doing in Butte this summer. And I'd say the imaging that I did was not nearly as impactful as the work that ended up being done on pen and paper by the residents of Centerville, which is one of the neighborhoods there that's under kind of a housing and urban development work. The residents had done a lot of work on rezoning their neighborhoods. They could get HUD money and get things cleaned up. And they have, like, you know, they've burned out buildings. And it's a beautiful neighborhood, but they're like whole sections of it that are just kind of industrial detritus that needs to be cleaned up. And none of that ended up on the internet. And that was on the request of the residents, who actually just kept it in the fire hall as paper maps, who went around with notebooks and collected information on, you know, who needed their houses repainted, who needed repair work. And no one wanted that shared publicly because they wanted to be able to get the HUD money to clean up their neighborhood, but they didn't want it all over the internet that, you know, someone couldn't afford to fix the structural problem in their wall, their house, or anything. And so there are definitely cases where social media and a huge response. I mean, heck, I got involved in the Gulf oil spill because of finding out through friends and connecting on the internet. But there are specific cases where, you know, sometimes sharing isn't even the best option.
What was the example? You mentioned that someone's using the title of the mapping with ArtBible.
Yeah, that was in Butte. And that was because, I mean, it's the Centerville neighborhood is really fascinating. It's like it was where the town started. This is a copper mining town. It's copper and silver mining at the beginning. And so Centerville became kind of this company town thing where people owned their houses but not the land it sat on. And so none of the houses have foundations. They're all on skids. And nothing's actually been moved since the 1930s, but all of them at some point in time had been dragged all over the hill. So people had photos and they were like, this is our house in 1890 over there, here it is in 1920 over here, and here's in 1935 where it is today. And so trying to, you know, and that came up because people were actually interested in decorative molding on their houses. And so these houses have been built in one specific area during one period with a specific type of decorative molding and then moved. And they're trying to figure out what they do for the, you know, historical color restoration and things like that. It's interesting. We're really excited about this NRG and NDVI, which is a vegetation analysis with two cameras. There's a lot of work on, I'd say the sensor technology we need to work on is just calibration of consumer hardware. It's very generically.
Well, we also, I mean, for instance, from being in Houston and trying to do some coordinating with, you know, Hackerspace and Air Alliance Houston that does monitoring around industrial facilities, because there's no zoning in Houston, which is incredible. We started thinking about, you know, taking like the blue mapping and making it into an air column monitor and hooking up different sensors. Because that's something that they identified as potentially applicable. From the thermal flashlight, we're looking at doing a thermal flash or thermal fishing bob, so that you can look at thermal heat leaks. So there's a number of different kind of directions that the sensing technology can take, and those are definitely, you know, community driven, based on what people are starting to look at in their areas. So.
I was just trying to navigate here to show you. They have a dedicated page on the site for the different tools that, that have been developed and are under development. So you can just go through here and examine the different approaches that have been taken. Just for information.
This is also fascinating. It's like a friend of mine from the Smith neighborhood in Toronto doing workshops teaching, doing the same useful SketchUp maps to imagine a clinic system in the community. So I wonder, are you also interested in that kind of stuff?
Yeah, we're very speculative. Yeah. Yeah. We, I mean, our spectrometer.
That's one of the we're working hard to get annotation layers into our mapping tools, so you can build these historical annotation layers, and that's a big thing, is taking control of imagery today so you can figure out what you want to do tomorrow.
I just wanted to use some of the language that's actually directly in the mission statement of Public Laboratory, and just wanted to quickly read that part. Where it says, the Public Laboratory for Open Technology and Science is a community, first thing, it's a community, which develops and applies open source tools to environmental exploration and investigation. By democratizing inexpensive and accessible do-it-yourself techniques, Public Laboratory creates a collaborative network of practitioners who actively reimagine the human relationship with the environment. And I think we need a lot of people doing that these days.
We started with public domain licenses for the spill imagery, just because we didn't want to have to deal with people contacting us all the time saying, oh, I want to publish this, I missed a deadline, I didn't quite get back on you. But so for the most of our mapping imagery, we've been going for public domain. For our print materials and instructions and things, we started with the Creative Commons share alike licensing. And then for the hardware, we're moving to the CERN open hardware license, which is an adaptation of the GPL to hardware. so it addresses the concerns with design patents and patentability issues that affect hardware, and also with just documentation sharing that's specific to hardware and not software. I don't know if that answered your question on do we recommend a license, though.
Yeah, I assume anyone obviously could choose to license to have an imagery, but yeah, that app that thing whatever they want, but yeah, that definitely
answers
my question.
Yes.
And a lot of the imagery is available also through their site. They encourage folks to go ahead and upload it. So through the archive section of the site, it's directly accessible there. But I think they're going to encounter, as more and more people get involved in the scale of the amount of data that's being collected increases, you know, there's going to need to be new approaches to managing that and making it machine understandable. So I think probably welcome ideas and directions to go with that.
Yeah, and just to clarify, yeah, if people do want to license their imagery, we've been encouraging them and pushing them towards the share alike Creative Commons license to allow both commercial and non-commercial uses. So.
You had a second part to that question. Did that answer that, or do you still have that question?
No, perfect.
Okay.
Are there any efforts for mapping C floors instead of going above?
Well, every once in a while I lose a camera in the Gulf of Mexico, so that's the first step. We'll get there eventually. No, not so far. We've had people in Indonesia that are interested in looking at reefs. I'm not sure how far along that project is at this point. I haven't really been following it too well, but you know, that's kind of the closest, but definitely not C4. So. Yep. Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay. Do you want to, can you say a bit more about that? Because I haven't been following this as much as I should have been.
Sorry.
Okay. Then
there's going to be, Blue Mappers, dedicated to water quality. So it's something I think
from that's Patch Bay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yes. are you interested in working on that? We'd love to hear from you.
Oh, no, it's just more of a question of, you know, with the oil spill, uh-huh. Creating an opportunity for not just for balloons, but
maybe something
that could be underwater that would do water analysis or even be an vegetation on seafloor. I know there's a lot of academic institutions that are being given large sums of money from BP to do research on the impact.
Yes.
And is that something that you would stray away from?
We won't take money from corporations or industries.
Has any academic institution approached you to use it as a major against their own data?
Okay, so I work with LUMCON. It's Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, and they had a mapping project they were looking at erosion rates throughout Barataria Bay, and so we were going out with them and doing aerial mapping both with, it was like a stereo rig for the infrared and visible light, and putting together composite imagery. And we're writing that up for a GSA, Geological Society of America issue right now. But, you know, like this researcher is interested in working with us because he sees a need for like kind of building some innovation into how he's approaching, you know, wetland loss problems that he's working on. So that's one instance. There's, you know, there's a couple other researchers that we've worked with that are incorporating it into. Yeah.
Sorry. Underwater is more difficult than that because you're talking about high pressures. You're talking very deep.
Thanks, Sam. We have time for about one more question. Anyone? Otherwise, I highly suggest you check out the Public Laboratory website, find people that, or find an issue that you're interested in and try to use some of the tools. They're fun, they're useful, and I feel like what really draws me to Public Laboratory is the diversity of people and the people you meet through the different meetups that are helping on the various issues. You have people that are community members. You have anthropologists, you have geographers, you have ecologists. It's just a wide range of people from different disciplines. So you learn a lot while learning about your terrain. So that's why I highly urge you to come join us at 2:30 today. It's the corner of East Campus and 23rd Street on University of Texas Austin's campus. We have some people from the University of Texas joining us today for some balloon mapping, potentially kite mapping. So bring your expertise and whatever you care about and come learn with us. So thank you for coming today.